Welcome back. It is Wednesday, the 27th day of March, 2013. I'm your host, Mark Call. Let's take a look at what's going on around the nation and around the world, starting with this one that gives us a good clue of the attitudes out there today, at least by those that understand what's really going on. And that would be Robert Shiller of the Case Shiller Company that does real estate analysis. And he said yesterday that one thing that makes it very hard to forecast home prices right now is that we're living in a totally artificial real estate economy. Shiller pointed to the Federal Reserve, which last week reaffirmed its policies on bond purchases and record low interest rates. Some would call this quantitative easing, where they're buying tens of billions of dollars of bad debt, a lot of it mortgage debt, per month. And meanwhile, the Business Insider and CNBC remind us, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two largest sources of funding in the United States, government-guaranteed funding at that, remain in conservatorship under the same government as Congress looks for ways to raise new tax revenues, noted Shiller. Quote, all of these things are weighing on the futures of housing, he said on CNBC's Futures Now, adding that the recovery, or what now passes for a recovery, might really just be a bubble. Quote, one thing you learn from history is that bubbles can occur at any time, unquote. Well, any time the government is messing in markets, especially. Robert Shiller, however, thinks that a real or full housing recovery might still be a long way off. He said that it could take as long as 40 years before prices again reach the pre-bubble, pre-crash levels of just a few years ago. And you know what? I don't know that that's true. Maybe he meant inflation-adjusted levels. After all it would really take is a couple of months of hyperinflation to make even a small bungalow be worth $20 million or so. Of course, Big Mac and fries might cost $50,000 at that point, too. And we'll get back to rigged markets and the inevitable meltdowns that result in just a minute. But first, let's take a look at continuing updates on the saga of what hasn't been told with respect to Benghazi and the murder of an ambassador there, or, well, what may have been a murder of not just an ambassador, but several other folks. This one comes from Aaron Klein out of WorldNet Daily, and it's an exclusive under the headline, New Scandal Threatens Obama and Hillary. The White House may have been misleading the public, the piece begins, by repeatedly denying it was coordinating arms shipments to rebels in Syria, insurgents known to consist in large part of al-Qaeda, as some call it, or al-Qaeda and other jihadist groups. Top U.S. officials and former officials, including former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, have implied, I like that word, in congressional testimony, they didn't know anything about U.S. involvement in procuring weapons for the rebels. But now a starkly different picture is emerging, says Klein, one that threatens the long-standing White House narrative. And that one claims that, of course, the Obama administration has only supplied non-lethal aid to the rebels. Confirming WorldNet Daily's exclusive reporting for over a year now, the New York Times, 2 days ago, reported something similar, that since early 2012, the CIA has been aiding Arab governments and Turkey in obtaining and shipping weapons to the Syrian rebels. In spite of that official narrative. While the Times report claims most of the weapons shipments facilitated by the CIA began after the latest presidential election, that would be convenient. Middle Eastern security officials speaking to WorldNet Daily have said that U.S.-aided weapon shipments go back more than a year, escalating before the September 11, 2012 attack on the U.S. facilities in Benghazi. WorldNet Daily and Aaron Klein go on to remind us about a lot of things that have been reported not so much by the waste stream, but by the alternative press for quite some time. For example, days after the Benghazi attack, WorldNet Daily reported that Ambassador Chris Stevens himself played a central role in recruiting jihadists to fight the Assad regime in Syria, according to Egyptian and other Middle Eastern security officials. Former General and former CIA Director David Petraeus may have been instrumental in helping set up an aviation network to fly in the weapons. Even the Times has said that Petraeus prodded various countries to work together on the plan, although they're now saying he did not return requests for comment. And there are, of course, a lot of other things that have not been adequately addressed, shall we say, by either testimony or the press, from rebel arms to rebel training to, well, what happened to Bashar Assad here over the last couple of days, if anything, and who done it? WorldNet Daily reminds us, with a bit of a pat on the back for themselves, that they were the first to reveal U.S. coordinated arms shipments, and now the New York Times and its reporting starkly contrasts with statements from both top U.S. officials and others who have denied aiding the supply of weapons to the rebels, not to mention what happened to the ambassador, and those who were killed in the process of doing their duty to protect him, and those high-ranking military officials who were ousted in the aftermath, and why. Turns out, just maybe, there may have been something that needed shutting up, I think is the bottom line to this entire story. Perhaps, if nothing else, the ambassador and those who were protecting him were somehow considered to be expendable by somebody. Wonder who that could have been. The Daily Mail has another story about not food, different kinds of not meat that are appearing in things that are being marketed in Britain as maybe being meat. Not too long ago, it was horses, remember? This story says that a mystery meat, which has defied the best efforts of scientists to identify it, has been found in a lamb curry in the United Kingdom as part of an investigation, and it's getting bigger and bigger all the time, into food fraud. The discovery, it says, raises new questions about just what is going on in the British nation's takeaways and processed foods. Refers to an upcoming BBC documentary, and it says, has dog meat been found in our food? New takeaway horror after experts discover that mystery meat. Samples of curries and kebabs from 6 outlets in London were tested. The meat in the lamb curry couldn't be identified as to what kind of animal it was. One burger they found contained no beef at all, other than a bit of blood and heart. And beef in another dish was found to contain chicken material, including blood. It gets more and more unsavory, but the bottom line is, gee, what are the Brits eating? What is being passed off as food? And they didn't even get around to asking about the genetically modified Franken stuff, either. And lest we forget, turning to these shores, the Supreme Court here. They are the only ones, recall, that are able to tell us what the Constitution actually means. You just hadn't noticed it before. Now they're getting ready to tell us whether or not what God wrote about marriage still applies in the former republics here. They're going to redefine, maybe, what marriage is and is not. There's a story by Cliff Kincaid up on the World Tribune about how not only is the Supreme Court anxious to do this, but the press is very hard at work trying to sell us on whatever may be coming. On the eve of Tuesday's March for Marriage, sick, whatever that means now, in Washington, and Supreme Court consideration of court cases on what is called homosexual rights, more evidence, says Kincaid, of the media bias driving the campaign to change America's culture and Judeo-Christian foundations has now emerged. Speaking at what was called a gay journalist event in New York City last week, Natalie Morales of NBC's Today Show declared, quote, many of us here in this room, the media, we are responsible for opening the world's eyes to these issues and the stories that have brought about such change. When you think 18 years ago when this organization was founded, think of where the country was back then. And now, 50%, according to the Pew poll that we talked about on the news today, that we pushed on the news today, as a matter of fact, support gay marriage. And some other polls put that number even higher. This, she says, evidently proudly, reflects a change in attitudes in this country. A change that they are very happy to continue to engineer. This, notes Kincaid, was not just an event where journalists came out of the closet for homosexual rights. It was a fundraiser for the cause. Cliff Kincaid nicely summarizes the position of the waste stream here in his conclusion when he says that now that the nature of the bias is evident for everyone to see, the bias will take yet another turn, as journalists will ignore the evidence that the major media has taken one side of the debate. What is significant, he says, is the lack of any real major media opposition to that bias. Hey, they've got an agenda to sell, your host will suggest, and it certainly seems to include a hatred for the supreme law of the land, particularly if you understand that supreme law to be based on a supreme creator and author of Scripture. CNS News has a great story up today about the President's commitment to the Second Amendment via some comments from White House Press Secretary Jay Carney. And it's interesting, and I guess you'd have to say illuminating, if nothing else. Carney was asked point blank about the fact that nearly 400 sheriffs across the nation have signed up and said they would not enforce unconstitutional new gun control, and I'll put this term in great big quotes, laws. In fact, notes CNS, the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, or CSPOA, has the support of 381 sheriffs and the cooperation of 15 state sheriff associations. asserting that they would not enforce either federal or state gun laws that they consider unconstitutional. Presumably, that simply means they've read the Second Amendment and they know what shall not be infringed means. It's pretty obvious. Unless, evidently, you read it the way they do in Washington, D.C. So what I'm going to do next is play the White House press secretary's answer. First, straight through, and then with a bit of analysis of what he's really saying. Because, as you may recall, I've observed that the White House often speaks the bald truth, but you have to parse it very, very carefully. I refer to it as the Clintonian truth, even.
Because, you know, it all depends on what the meaning of the word is.
And without question, it certainly depends on what the meaning of the word infringed is, and sometimes, more importantly, even who we are. You might be forgiven for thinking that shall not ought to be pretty clear, but then, of course, it too depends on who we are that are doing the infringing. So, here we go. Remember, the question is, would the administration have a problem with these 381 sheriffs who've already said they won't enforce unconstitutional so-called law?
Well, I haven't seen the letters that you reference. I think that as a general proposition, we think that people ought to follow the law. And as a absolute matter of fact, in my view, and I think many others, including constitutional experts, there's not a single measure in this package of proposals the president has put forward that in any way violates the Constitution. In fact, they reflect the president's commitment to our Second Amendment rights.
Wow, there you have it. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. Doesn't matter what you think the law says, and no matter how clearly the founders attempted to write it so that it couldn't be misconstrued, improperly constructed, twisted, or otherwise turned on its head, well, they seem to be channeling Lewis Carroll's Humpty Dumpty, who said, "The law means what I mean it to mean, nothing more and nothing less." So let's take it from the top, a phrase at a time.
As a general proposition, we think that people ought to follow the law.
Well, there you go. That sounds pretty clear. We think that people ought to follow the law. Well, then the question becomes, so why doesn't the administration? Whether it's Fast and Furious or drone killings or warrantless wiretaps, you know, Fourth Amendment be damned, or just plain lack of due process, we can kill anybody we want without worrying about the law. I think what he means is the people must follow the law, not us. And the law, of course, isn't necessarily what's written, it's what we say it is. Today. So now we're up to the real whopper. Listen carefully, very carefully.
And as a absolute matter of fact, in my view, and I think many others, including constitutional experts...
Oh, wait, there it is. Did you catch that? You peons, you are too stupid to understand what simple words like shall not or shall not be infringed mean. We must tell you what they mean. And, of course, constitutional experts are the only ones who can actually understand what the founders meant there, even though they repeatedly said the idea was to make sure that even an idiot could understand it. And again, you might think that's why they used simple declarative sentences like shall not be infringed, particularly when everyone at the time understood that infringed was the most powerful word in the English language of its kind. It meant don't even think about getting close to this God-given right with a restriction. And I guess that tells you the rest of the story.
There's not a single measure in this package of proposals the president has put forward that in any way violates the Constitution. In fact, they reflect the president's commitment to our Second Amendment rights.
Well, you could read that to say nothing in here infringes what's left of your once God-given rights, now converted into privileges. That would be an acceptable reading, certainly true. But let's hear it again.
There's not a single measure in this package of proposals the president has put forward that in any way violates the Constitution. In fact, they reflect the president's commitment to our Second Amendment rights.
And at first blush, or second blush, that too sounds indisputable. What we're seeing is the depth of the president's commitment to the Second Amendment, for what that's worth. But listen one more time.
There's not a single measure in this package of proposals the president has put forward that in any way violates the Constitution. In fact, they reflect the president's commitment to our Second Amendment rights.
Ah, see, that time we heard it. Now the truth will out. They reflect his commitment to our Second Amendment rights. So the question simply boils down to, well, who has the right to keep and bear arms and who doesn't? Clearly, we do. Just us. Think of the Department of Just Us, who decides, fast and furiously, that foreign drug lords can have assault rifles, but American patriots can't. The president's kids, you see, they have the right to be defended by people carrying guns, lots and lots of guns, unlike those at Sandy Hook Elementary, who were in a disarmed killing field. When the president goes out, he tells you that guns don't make you safer, especially the kind that you won't be allowed to have anyway. But just us, well, we're surrounded by lots and lots of people with guns, with magazines that hold lots and lots of bullets, too. And by the way, they're guns that you aren't permitted to have without permission. These are full auto kind of guns. When you have them, they're called assault rifles, and they're semi-auto, for now. Not the full auto kind that we have. And when the Department of Octung Homeland Security buys them, they're no longer called assault rifles. They become full auto personal defense weapons. Can you see? It's really clear when you understand it in context. You don't have any rights. But we, those who are deserving of protection, do.
They reflect the president's commitment to our Second Amendment rights.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
And before we move on, as much as this disgusts me, I've got to do this quick line from a piece in the freebeacon.com about a so-called senator. I support the real senator from Connecticut, not this guy. You'll know what that means in a second. Chris Murphy from Connecticut, who said he supports the real Second Amendment yesterday in a discussion about gun control on a TV show called The Situation Room. Now, listen to this one. A lot of senators believe that the Second Amendment is absolute, unquote. I guess by that he means there are still some senators who believe what is written is what it actually says. But Connecticut Senator Murphy said it's not. I support the Second Amendment. I just support the real Second Amendment. And the real Second Amendment allows Congress and our community to put reasonable restrictions, some would say infringements, on the kind of guns that are available to the peons. So maybe it can't get any clearer than that. Thank you, Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut, for telling us the truth. There is what is written in that old-fashioned Constitution thing, and then there is the real Second Amendment that only people like him, the truly enlightened ones, can see. Because it's real, don't you know? We do not want to lose sight today of the fact that the world market meltdown continues. Maybe you could say the chickens are coming home to roost, or at least that people who are paying attention are more and more beginning to realize just how badly they've been duped and what the next steps might be. Tyler Durden of Zero Hedge has a market update out. It's called The Damage So Far. And it begins by noting that the realizations are the following. A. Cyprus mattered. And B. If Europe slumps, then the U.S. will be infected. No matter how clean the asset gatherers believe their shirt to be, all of that is again impacting markets globally. A slew of horrible data overnight, they say, following yesterday's U.S. data disappointments. U.S. earnings bellwether misses and so forth, is finally, now that the quarter is coming to an end, having some impact on the manipulated market euphoria. European stock markets are dropping rapidly, with Spain and Italy down 5-6% this week. Spanish, Italian, and Portuguese bond spreads have blown back wider. The Spanish yields are now back over 5%, and that's a 30-40 basis point increase this week alone. The euro to U.S. dollar ratio is getting monkey hammered, and it's back below $1.28 on the euro at this point, its lowest in over 4 months. European and U.S. banks are also in trouble, with the former now negative year to date. Finally, it says U.S. treasuries are well bid on what is called safe haven flow. I like the way analyst Jim Poplava puts it. The worst house in a really, really bad neighborhood looks great by comparison. But only by comparison. Reuters informs us today that a British security firm called G4S, it transports cash for Cypriot banks, has been working round the clock, sending out teams with police protection in order to stock up bank machines and prepare guards for when the banks just may reopen on Thursday. And they may really be needed, says Zero Hedge, because they've got a headline up about a furious Cyprus, which has now begun investigating just who breached the capital controls that were supposed to protect depositors there. They reminded us that on Monday, they reported very disturbing news that despite ongoing liquidity blockades around the little island nation, capital controls and the somewhat closed Cyprus banks, that means closed to the peons. Why does that sound familiar today? One particular group of people. The very same group targeted to prompt this whole ludicrous collapse of the island nation, says Zero Hedge. Russian oligarchs, some of them may have been former KGB too, found ways to bypass that ring fence and pull their money out. Quickly and quietly. They speculated that if the Cypriot people found out about this, they would be angry. Very, very angry. And it turns out, notes Tyler Durden, that they did find out about it, and they did become angry. Questions are now finally starting. Zero Hedge next quotes a report from the German Der Spiegel, which says the Cypriot parliament, which may or may not last too long once the banks reopen tomorrow and people realize that they are in a fractional reserve banking system, where deposits you thought were there are now gone. Poof! Well, Der Spiegel says that the Cypriot parliament has begun investigating the capital flight. That may mean the destruction of Cyprus has all been for naught. Sadly, notes Zero Hedge, it's now too little, too late. There's a whole lot of detail in this story, much of which we've already talked about over the last few days, but this is the part that your host finds particularly ironic. Der Spiegel says the central bank in Cyprus now stands accused of not doing enough to control the movement of capital. See, we closed the banks to make sure you couldn't get your money out. And now, surprise, we're going to try to convince you that we should have done more of the same. How's that for people leaning into a sucker punch? And where have we heard this story before? Yes, the capital controls there. You can't have your money, and it's for your own good. But we, don't forget this, we believe in the rule of law for us. Here comes the sucker punch. Transfers for humanitarian aid were permitted, of course, and many people are also furious that the bank allowed special payments, the definitions for which, surprise, surprise, were never adequately established. But I'll bet you they would all agree that no rights were infringed in the process. You could say it this way: the more things change, the more they stay the same. Or as Solomon once put it in the book of Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun. Zero Hedge summarizes it this way: the better question now is how much longer will the rule of law remain in Cyprus once full-blown class warfare is unleashed? And the 99% are generously handed the list of the 1% who were informed enough in advance to be able to pull their money out from the flaming sovereign equivalent of the local Bernie Madoff, while every other uninsured depositor is facing losses of up to 80% and soon 100% of what they thought was their money. And what happens, concludes Zero Hedge, if the realization eventually dawns that despite all the promises about even insured investments, those investors will eventually get impaired once the money, or what now passes for it, runs out. We'll wrap it up today with this piece from Simon Black, again courtesy of Zero Hedge, which says, expect these 8 steps from the government playbook. He runs them by. Most of them will sound familiar. 1, direct confiscation. We're seeing that in Cyprus. 2, taxes, whatever they may be called. Obamacare is an example of this one, but there are other forms of confiscation. They were called levies in Cyprus for a while, too. 3, inflation. Call it indirect confiscation. The slow, gradual plundering of people's savings. This has worked quite well once governments figured out how to hide it. Capital controls. Well, that worked pretty well in Cyprus, right? Wage and price controls. And of course, when that fails, wage and price controls on steroids. Finally, 7, increased regulation. Yes, the regulation we have didn't work because it exempts, usually, just us. So what we need is more of it. And finally, when all else fails, war and national emergency. Pick a fight and keep people distracted. It could be, Black suggests, some men in caves or some completely irrelevant island. But I'm sure other options will emerge as we see what develops. Thanks for joining us today. Chag Sameach, and Shabbat Shalom if you're keeping the Feast of Pesach at this time. And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.